protesters gather in Seoul, where a meeting is underway between the presidents of South Korea and the U.S. Coming up, our live report from Seoul. Russia cuts off gas flow to Finland over its refusal to pay for future supplies in rubles. Also, Syria says it intercepted most of the Israeli missiles that targeted the south of Damascus, also confirming 3 fatalities. Thank you for joining us. The top story this hour, activists have gathered near the presidential office in South Korea's capital, Seoul, to protest against U.S. President Joe Biden's visit to the country. The demonstrators are against military cooperation between the U.S., South Korea, and Japan, arguing that it would provoke an arms race. They also say Washington's aggressive military strategy will intensify the already escalating situation on the Korean Peninsula. Similar protests took place in Seoul on Friday. The U.S. president has just met with his South Korean president, Yoon Suk-yeol. Biden said the 70-year alliance between the two countries was built on working together to deter North Korea. He said it also aims to keep the Indo-Pacific region free and open. Jennifer Chang, our correspondent in Seoul, joins us now. Jennifer, it's good to talk to you. Thank you for being with us. Tell us more about the security situation in Seoul right now. Is there a heavy police presence? How big are the protests? And what are the protesters' top demands?
...have taken to the streets. They are polarized. One group consists of older South Koreans who favor the U.S.-South Korea alliance. The other part of the protesters consists of younger South Koreans who want the alliance to be over. They say it endangers peace on the Korean Peninsula and increases the chance of war, saying that President Biden's visit to South Korea is not good for the South. The president of America is meeting the newly elected president of South Korea, Yoon Suk-yeol, and is going to be stressing the power of the South Korea-U.S. military and economic alliance. They are going to cooperate on semiconductor chip production aimed at decreasing reliance on Chinese semiconductors. So this is a visit not only aimed at deterring North Korea here in South Korea, but also to rein in China. And after this visit, President Biden will be going to Japan tomorrow, and he will be there for an additional 2 days or so. And meanwhile, China announced it will start military drills in the South China Sea. So things are really getting tense here. Not only that, but North Korea is all prepared to do a 7th nuclear test. It's first in 5 years. Also, it is ready to do an ICBM test at any moment. Intelligence has detected signs that it could be fired off any second now. So this is looming over the Biden visit here. And President Biden and President Yoon Suk-yeol say that they will change their schedule for their summit here in Seoul. And they are going to take control of the command and control structure of the two countries' armed forces.
So I want you to tell us more about the security situation in Seoul right now. I want you to give us some information as to how large the gatherings are, the rallies are.
Well, exact figures have not been published yet, but a total of 10,600 or so protesters are out on the street. And the anti-U.S. protests are all over the place, scattered all over. President Biden is staying at the Grand Hyatt Seoul Hotel. There has been an anti-U.S. protest and picketing there. There has been an additional protest here at the Defense Ministry, where the South Korean president, who's been newly elected, Yoon Suk-yeol, will be working from. This is the new presidential office, this Defense Ministry compound, And the anti-U.S. group got a special court order. It overturned a previous court decision that allows it to hold a protest here. So that was a big legal victory for the anti-U.S. protesters.
Right.
And in addition to that, there was another anti-U.S. protest in downtown Seoul in the Gwanghwamun area, and they were scheduled to move to this defense ministry compound area.
Thank you.
There is heavy police surveillance.
Right. Biden will next travel to Tokyo. Walk us through the significance of the quadrilateral security dialogue that he is going to attend while in Japan. Is the Quad expected to challenge China?
Well, of course, President Biden wants to rein in China by having the nations of India, Australia, Japan join the U.S. as a quartet in suppressing China. And South Korea has talked about joining the Quad. So this is a move, of course, welcomed by the U.S. It may not have stated officially yet that it is very pleased, but no doubt the U.S. is very pleased because the predecessor to the Korean president, Yoon Suk-yeol, favored engagement with North Korea and did not want anything to do with the Quad. So this is a big victory for the U.S. And the only problem is that North Korea has this nuclear power. They can do a nuclear test, an ICBM test at any time. And that will highlight the failure of the U.S. to engage the North in dialogue, despite repeated attempts to get the North to talk about denuclearizing. The U.S. has failed to do any of that, and there is concern that the U.S. is slipping back into the strategic patience of the Obama administration, in which Biden served as vice president. This gives North Korea even more room to develop its nuclear program, and the South Koreans are worried about that. This is a big, big problem for the new South Korean president.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, thank you so much for coming on. That was Jennifer Chang, our correspondent in Seoul. Moving on, Australians are heading to the polls in the federal election that will decide the next prime minister. About 17 million people are expected to cast their ballots. They will elect lawmakers for the House of Representatives and just over half of the seats in the Senate. Australia's ruling Liberal National Coalition and Labour Party are main contenders. Each party needs at least 76 of the 151 House seats to form a government. The hung parliament will need them to try to win support from independent MPs or minor parties. Inflation and climate change are the main concerns of the voters. Australia's inflation has surged to 5.1%. That's 2.3% higher than wage growth. The country's cost of living has surged to a 21-year high. Russia has just cut off flow of natural gas to Finland after it refused to pay for future supplies in the Russian national currency. Finland's energy firm says, though regrettable, the halt will cause no disruptions in the gas transmission network. Gazprom says it's been carefully preparing for the situation. Last Saturday, Russia also cut electricity deliveries to Finland over payment issues. The developments come as Finland and Sweden are planning to join NATO. The two submitted bids on Wednesday. Russia is opposed to their move, citing security threats caused by NATO expansion. Moscow has promised retaliation should Finland and Sweden join the Western military alliance. Our correspondent Marina Kurtanova in Moscow tells us how European countries have responded to Russian demands for payments in rubles.
Russia's Gazprom expert announced on Friday that Gazprom also failed to pay for the natural gas deliveries in April. Poland, Bulgaria, and Finland refused to comply with Moscow's demand, and deliveries to these countries were stopped. Finnish promised to apply to arbitration. So, as you know, Russian president said on March 23rd that unfriendly states must pay for Russian gas in rubles, saying it refused to accept payments under gas those states in compromised currencies, particularly meaning dollars and. As you know, Germany allowed companies to open ruble and pay for gas. So the reports say that Berlin told German gas importers that they could open ruble accounts to pay for energy, provided that payments to Russia's Gazprom Bank are in foreign currency.
Russia says it has taken full control of the strategic port city of Mariupol after the last remaining Ukrainian fighters holed up in a steel plant put down their arms. Russia's defense ministry says the army has completely liberated the Azovstal steelworks, which was the last stronghold of the Ukrainian forces in the southern city. According to the ministry, more than 500 Ukrainian forces surrendered to Russian forces on Friday. Russia took over other parts of Mariupol 2 months ago. The city is the largest Russia has captured since February the 24th, when it began its military operation in Ukraine. Control over Mariupol helps Russia establish a land corridor from Crimea to eastern Ukraine. An anti-war rally has been held in Rome. People have marched through the city center demanding the Italian executive and Brussels to halt weapons deliveries to Kiev and seriously commit to a negotiating table aimed at stopping the conflict. Max Civelli has more from Rome.
On Friday, about 2,000 people staged a rally in the Italian capital, calling on the Mario Draghi government and the EU to stop sending weapons to Kyiv and finally promote peace talks to resolve the war in Ukraine. The initiative had been called by a number of base unions and supported by a string of leftist movements. People at the rally expressed high concern over the serious military escalation by all parties involved in the Ukraine conflict.
The EU is not acting right. Its wary posture has only put one bloc against another. The people are those who will suffer from our rulers' decisions in the end.
There are too many conflicting interests at stake, and Italy is far to survive. The EU should do more. I don't support Putin, but I'm also against Zelensky. He is not acting in the interests of the Ukrainians.
Following the start of the conflict in Ukraine, Italy has opted to gradually cut its gas reliance on Russia. Rome has been importing gas from Moscow for over 50 years, and about 45% of its total demand is provided by Russia.
I'm a small retailer. I was forced to close down during the COVID, but I haven't seen a cent of support from the government. And now they spend billions for the war. When will they look after us?
Undoubtedly, the Italian government is far too aligned with NATO, but it's not just that. The government is very much distant from the people, as surveys show the majority of the Italians are against the war.
Since the start of the conflict, opinion polls have steadily shown half of the Italians oppose the sending of weapons to Ukraine and believe sanctions against Russia are useless. About one-fifth of the surveyed Italians have so far said they are in support of the Draghi government's delivery of heavy weapons to Kyiv.
The conflict in Ukraine, its dire consequences and the fear it could spread or go on for a long time are not the only worries Italians are concerned with. Rising inflation, the growing cost of energy, blocked salaries, continual crumbling of purchasing power, all economic indicators are pointing towards a recession. Many expect the country to be faced with a hot autumn of strikes and protests. Max Civelli, Rome.
Welcome back. Syria says its air defenses have intercepted Israeli missiles during a fresh attack near the capital Damascus. Syria's defense ministry says the strikes left three people dead and led to some material damage. Earlier, Syrian media reported that air defenses confronted quote-unquote hostile targets in the sky in the Damascus countryside. The report said the Israeli attack also caused a fire near Damascus International Airport, delaying a number of flights. Israel earlier launched a volley of missiles on Syria on May the 14th, killing five Syrian soldiers. Our Damascus correspondent Mohammed Ali tells us more about the repeated acts of Israeli aggression against Syria.
According to an official military source, at about 11 p.m. local time in Damascus, Israel carried out a missile attack, a surface-to-surface missile attack, which was launched from the occupied Syrian Golan and hit targets in areas in the southern countryside of Damascus. Right away, Syria's air defenses, as usual, intercepted the attack, shooting down most of the enemy missiles. However, it seems that some of them did hit their targets, because three persons were killed as a result of this attack. Now, definitely, this is not the first kind of attack, especially this year, or at least this month, in which Israel stepped up its attacks whether in central Syria, in areas like Musyaf and Hama, or around the Syrian capital, Damascus, or in the south, around Al-Quneitra. Syria always sends letters to the United Nations Security Council and Secretary General with regards to such attacks. But so far, despite the tens of letters, there are still international silence about this. Still, there is no action being taken as an independent country is being attacked, a sovereign country is being attacked.
Israeli forces shoot dead a Palestinian teenager during a raid on Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry says troopers also opened fire on an 18-year-old, leaving him in critical condition. The incident comes days after the Israeli military killed Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Aghla while she was covering a regime raid on the refugee camp. In recent months, Jenin has been at the center of tensions in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli regime has recently escalated its atrocities against Palestinians in the occupied territories. More than 20 Palestinians have been killed at the hands of Israeli forces since the end of March. Mona Candila, our correspondent, says Israeli forces keep attacking the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank in retaliation for Palestinians' anti-Israel operations.
Israeli forces continue to raid Jenin refugee camp and the city because a number of Palestinians from Jenin carried out anti-Israel operations and left Israeli settlers dead and wounded in the last few months. And this, of course, had angered the Israeli military and the Israeli street as well. So in order to silence the Israeli settlers and the demands by the Israelis to change the Israeli cabinet, the Israeli forces continue to raid Jenin and its refugee camp almost on a daily basis, storming Palestinians' homes, arresting people, shooting at Palestinians and Palestinian youths.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. In Britain, police chiefs will declare they're ashamed about racism remaining in law enforcement and apologise for the discrimination and bias still plaguing police forces in a new race plan which will launch next week. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Bikram Dodd. The piece is titled Police Chiefs to Apologise for Racism, Discrimination and Bias in Race Plan. Britain police chiefs will declare they're ashamed about racism remaining in law enforcement and apologise for the discrimination and bias still plaguing police forces in a new race plan which will launch next week. The plan from National Police Chiefs Council and College of Policing will avoid admitting institutional racism, which critics brand a failure which could doom the promised reforms. However, it will instead commit to being institutionally anti-racist and aim to start winning back the confidence of black people, which among black Caribbean people is 20% lower than the national average. They vow to end the treatment which black people find stigmatizing and humiliating, and police chiefs from England and Wales will say, "We accept that policing still contains racism, discrimination and bias. We're ashamed of those truths, we apologize for them, and we are determined to change them." The plan, running to more than 50 pages, follows months of intense and at times bitter discussions. It was triggered by the mass protests after the murder of George Floyd in the United States by a police officer, and has taken so long it will be published just a day before the second anniversary of George Floyd's death. The document and planned reforms comes after decades of promises by policing to stamp out racism in the ranks and failure to deliver. In 1999, policing was declared to be institutionally racist by the McPherson Inquiry into the police blunders that allowed the racist murderers of Stephen Lawrence to escape justice after he was stabbed to death at a London bus stop. Policing has in large part, especially in the Met, declared that the label no longer applies. The Guardian has revealed chiefs were debating a public declaration almost a quarter of a century on, from the McPherson Inquiry, that policing remained so. Some chief constables and community experts that consulted insisted that accepting the label was the essential starting point to repair the damage. Otherwise, any plan risked never even getting a hearing from the communities weary of promises and false claims they had been delivered. Police leaders could not agree to accept forces were still institutionally racist, even holding a vote. The police chiefs will say much has been done in the intervening years by policing to address racism in the police and society. Despite this, change has not been fast nor significant enough in black communities. As we have prepared this plan, we have heard the views of black people on their experiences of policing. We have listened to the voices of our own black colleagues about the service that they belong to. The challenge for reform set out by the McPherson Inquiry cannot be said to have been unambiguously answered by policing. Many people believe policing is still institutionally racist and have grounds for this view. The murder of George Floyd in the United States saw over 250,000 people take to streets in Britain in support of Black Lives Matter movement and calls for racial justice in a phalanx of protests, despite the country being in lockdown. Discussions within policing and ethnic minority officers saw some police chiefs realize the race problems in their forces were more severe than they had realized. The document says, "We have much to do to secure the confidence of black people, including our own staff, and improve their experience of policing. And we will. We will be held to account and we welcome scrutiny." That need for change is evident. Policing lags behind almost every part of the public service as an employer of colour for black people. Confidence levels are much lower and our power are disproportionately applied to black people. In some crimes, victimisation rates are higher. Black police officers and staff leave policing earlier in their careers than white staff, and the fact we have only seen two black officers reach chief constable or assistant commissioner rank in policing history is a failure in itself. One police chief constable who supports accepting policing is institutionally racist said, all the figures show it still is. One chief, who opposed it, said the label was unhelpful and not accurate. Victor Olissa, former head of diversity at Scotland Yard, said failing to admit institutional racism will blow the credibility of the new promises. They may say that they will do better, but without an admission of the institutional racism, it wouldn't be believed in communities. Police chiefs are being insular and doing what suits them and not the service of the public. The police chiefs will say that the argument that policing reflects biases in society is not good enough. Policing has a much higher obligation than any other public service, given its ability to deprive liberty and use the most intrusive powers. The collective trust of society is critical to a police service built upon consent. Sources involved in discussion said while high on aspiration, the plan risked lacking specifics. Police chiefs will adopt a policy to explain or reform on racial disparities, such as stop and search, and the plan will say black people are 7 times more likely to be stopped and searched than white people, and 5 times more likely to be subjected to the use of force. Testimonies tell us that black people find these encounters, particularly stop and search, confrontational, stigmatizing and humiliating. 10% of our recorded searches, 27% of use of force incidents and 35% of taser incidents involved someone from the black ethnic group. The latest estimate suggests that only 3.5% of the population is black. Police chiefs have brought in independent scrutiny, and the public will be encouraged to give their views on that plan. The plan is produced by the NPCC and the College of Policing and will now be consulted upon and may change. They state their aim is, "Our vision is for a police service that is anti-racist and trusted by black people."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to another edition of Spotlight. In this edition, the BRICS countries have backed a Chinese suggestion that the bloc should be expanded. A joint statement by the foreign ministers of the bloc, which also includes Brazil, Russia, India, and South Africa, following an online meeting on Thursday, supported its first expansion in a decade. However, no candidate countries have been named so far. In this edition of Spotlight, we will be discussing the possible expansion of BRICS and what that means on a global scale. To discuss that further, we have with us the Washington Bureau Chief, Executive Intelligence Review, William Jones, and also author and journalist Arnold August. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's begin with our guest, William Jones. Why do you think BRICS's expansion is being proposed at this point in time?
Well, look, what you have in the world now is the United States is out to bring the countries of the world together in a policy of degrading Russia, essentially decoupling Russia from the world community, in effect. They have succeeded in bringing their European counterparts on board, although not without opposition. And now, of course, President Biden is in Japan working on the Asia-Pacific side of this. This campaign is, first of all, directed against Russia, but also against China. The United States administration, the Biden administration today, has the policy that they must be the rule givers of the world. It is a policy of great hubris. And of course, hubris is also sometimes a very dangerous quality. Most of the world is opposed to this policy, including, I believe, even within the countries that have gone along with it. I think they're going to see a lot of opposition. China knows that it is also a target of this policy, has extensive relations with many, many countries, and has been a strong proponent of economic development over the last 10, 20 years, actually the strongest proponent. The BRICS cooperation has been a part of bringing together countries, particularly in the developing sector, to call for more multilateralism, to assure that other countries other than the great powers, so-called, have a say in the direction of the world. And at this point in time, of course, there is a question. Where is the world going? Will it go to this one world dictatorship of the United States, or will other countries become involved and raise their voices? The other countries are not organized in the same way as NATO and the U.S. alliances, and therefore I think this is a step in the direction of increasing the number of groups that are working together to defend the issue of multilateralism.
Okay, so Mr. August, we just heard Mr. Jones pointing to some geostrategic developments, including the war in Ukraine and the U.S.-led NATO expansion and all that. Do you think that that has anything to do with a BRICS decision to expand and enroll more countries? What is your point of view on that?
Definitely, I agree. In fact, one has to take into account that this is the first BRICS meeting since the February 24th Russian special military operation in Ukraine. It's very significant, I guess a bit ironic, because in my view, one of the reasons that the NATO pushed Russia to the brink was to try and weaken Russia. As a result, what they don't like is the increasing collaboration between Russia and China. So here we've come full circle since then, today, in May, when China has bounced back in order to propose the enlargement of BRICS. And if I recall correctly, the five members of BRICS, three of them abstained when the United Nations General Assembly voted on the American-backed resolution to impose sanctions against Russia. So three out of five abstained. So right there you have another ripple effect of what happened since February 2000, this past year. And once again, I think it's poetic justice that China is at the center, along with their allies on an equal basis, such as the other members of BRICS, to strive to expand the already burgeoning, already developing multipolar world against U.S. hegemony. It had very important effects. For example, even in Latin America, there is a big controversy going on now with regards to the U.S. so-called Summit of the Americas in June 2022, in which they are excluding countries such as Cuba, Venezuela, etc. So you have a situation now where perhaps will Argentina be asked to become one of the additional members of BRICS, which is quite possible because Argentina visited China at a crucial time when the U.S. Narrative against Russia was taking place. And what if Argentina is asked to join BRICS? It would be great. And then how will this affect the upcoming summit that's going to take place in Los Angeles, if it takes place, because so many countries have refused to bow down to the U.S. dictate that they are excluding Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua. So this is only the beginning. I think it will have very important effects not only in Latin America, obviously in Europe, and also the rest of Asia.
Okay, so Mr. Jones, as Mr. August also pointed out, we have Argentina standing in line. Earlier this year, Argentina had expressed its desire to join the bloc, and analysts say Indonesia is also a likely candidate. How could these two countries contribute to the bloc? Or would this change BRICS?
Well, no, I think it would strengthen BRICS, as a matter of fact. BRICS has, of course, its economic cooperation, but it's also they make statements on the international situation, which are extremely important. And in spite of the diversity of countries, they can always find some commonality with regard to the direction that the world should go. That is, commonalities in terms of supporting statements, for instance, as in the BRICS statement today, calling for peace negotiations on the Ukraine-Russia border, which, of course, the United States is opposed to and is does not want to see happen anytime soon until Russia is degraded. So that it has an important political role, but it also an important economic role. And this is one of the organizations. Look, the developing countries over the last 50 years have done a lot of things to try and bring together their united force in order to bring forward a global development policy. This has never really succeeded. We go back to the Bandung Conference, which was probably the initial attempt at this, and it hasn't succeeded. It hasn't succeeded because they haven't been able to create the kind of a force that can counter the power of the Western economies in determining the fate of the world. And therefore, this will bring together whatever choices are made in the short term. And I do see that an expansion of BRICS will not be limited only to one or two countries, but potentially it can be even greater, because this is one of the main organizations that has been consistently pushing for global development policy. And of course, you know that you notice that President Xi addressed the BRICS meeting, and he underlined two major important points. One is the need for this global security initiative. That is, that the world must be based on the idea that the security of one nation cannot be done at the expense of another nation. Of course, this is what is central to this whole Russia-Ukraine crisis. And the second thing was that he insisted that they work together collaboratively on the issue of development. And of course, China has put forward this global development initiative, which, if realized, would begin to repeat the successes that China has had in their own country in terms of poverty alleviation. So these are things in which the BRICS countries, as they're constituted today, in addition of any other developing sector countries, would only strengthen the momentum towards development and towards peace. So I think this is a very important step that they're taking.
Okay, so Mr. August, you seem to be agreeing with our other guests here. So I would like to know what you think about how the expansion of BRICS can change the political landscape.
Okay, well, the previous speaker already mentioned that point, but I would like to expand on one point. In addition to the obvious economic factors of integration and cooperation, there are very important political factors. Just reading from the Chinese report, according to it, Xi Jinping, he said that these five countries should coordinate closely on major international and regional issues, take care of each other's core interests and concerns, and respect each other's sovereignty, security, and development interests. And went on to say, the president, she went on to say, to oppose hegemonism and power politics. And this is important, in my view. He went on to say, resist Cold War thinking and block confrontation. So it's economic, but I think it's a very important step in terms of the, resisting the Cold War that is sweeping the world as a result of U.S.-NATO domination. And this is sort of a challenge to that mainstream narrative that people should, of the world, countries especially in the global south, should stand up to this whole very dangerous narrative that is going on, and instead take a common position, even if they have different political system, which they obviously did. For example, Brazil at this time on one hand, and China on the other, India, of course, very different political and economic system, but China is playing an important role to try to weld these different countries with different system towards an increasingly stronger opposition to U.S. hegemony and in favor of a multipolar world.
Well, exactly, and of course, we also have to point out that this announcement comes at a time that the BRICS New Development Bank, the NDP, has opened its Indian regional office. So, Mr. Jones, how can financial cooperation between the member states affect Western hegemony?
Well, it's obviously the initiation of the Belt and Road Initiative was a game changer in development policy. For the first time in decades, there was a major shift, major push to try and institute development based on interconnectivity, based on building railroads, bringing the world together. This has always been central. The United States developed like this. Russia developed like this. Railroads and connectivity is essential to creating the basis of infrastructure in which economic development can occur. Now, what also happened at that time is that new institutions like the AIIB and the BRICS New Development Bank were set up specifically to finance infrastructure development. The old development banks, World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, they had long left the field of infrastructure development because they felt it takes too long financially, there's not quick profits. And a variety of reasons, and a general disinterest in any kind of major program to create economic development in places like Africa and Latin America, and that these new development banks, like the BRICS Development Bank, created a new momentum. They're going to be even more important now because, look, the money that is being spent on this war effort and the sanctions that are being imposed on Russia in particular, but also on China, is going to create a major financial crisis in the world. We're looking at what's happening in food prices now and energy prices. This is going to get much, much worse, making it almost impossible for, without a major reform in the international financial system, for any kind of development policies in these parts of the world. So that's also what the fight is all about, to try and maintain the financial capabilities of pushing economic development. And it's going to take more than simply the existence of these various banks. It's going to require a major reform of the international financial system. And my suspicion is that given the dangerous situation that we're facing with the real possibilities of a nuclear war, I think there's going to be such serious economic consequences that you're going to have a reaction in most of the countries of the world against this war policy. And maybe that would provide the basis for people to take a look and say, pull together a financial system that works for the benefit of the people and not for the profits of the few.
Okay, so considering what Mr. Jones just mentioned, Mr. August, do you think that this kind of financial cooperation can help counter U.S. sanctions?
Well, I think it is actually happening now, especially since February 24th, 2022, where there have been, collaboration with regards to currency going on between, on the one hand, Russia and China and other countries in Asia. So this new BRICS orientation, especially if it allows and is successful in bringing other countries into BRICS, it'll even stimulate further the search for alternative currencies based on the U.S. dollar. For example, I don't have the exact figures, but since the U.S. tried to punish Russia with regards to currency, the ruble, the value of the ruble has increased considerably. So there are very many possibilities that are coming out of this new situation. I'd just like to add one point. When the United Nations General Assembly took place and the U.S. resolution to condemn Russia, China abstained. Some people say, oh, well, why didn't China oppose it? China was right. It abstained in order to maintain its very favorable position internationally as an important power, not imperialist, as some would like to say, but an important progressive anti-imperialist power to try to rally other countries that have different political systems and even perhaps different views on the issue of Russia. So this very wise Chinese decision to abstain in the United Nations is now bearing fruit, as we see China is being successful in further developing a whole block against U.S. hegemony, not only with regards to Ukraine, but in general, all of U.S. policy. For example, looking forward to China, we know the United States is also trying to provoke something with regards to Taiwan. So these countries, BRICS, and any new countries that adhere to BRICS will be on the side of China against the attempt that we know is going on by the U.S. to try to provoke something with regards to China by instigating some kind of a rebellion or whatever by Taiwan against the Chinese government.
Okay, so Mr. Jones, do you believe that this could all lead to the weakening of the U.S. dollar?
Well, it already is. And of course, in terms of the financial cooperation between Russia and China, there are already measures being taken in order to maintain the cooperation in terms of the physical economy. Financial arrangements are being made. The RMB is already playing a major role, not as a reserve currency, but as a currency which is becoming dominant in many of the transactions that China has with all the other countries. So in one sense, the United States could be shooting itself in the foot with this $30 billion to Ukraine rather than to New York or to California, because that is causing major inflation. The dollar is going down. The stock market is at least starting to tank, and it's up and down, but it's moving in the direction downward. And this may end the dollar hegemony, which has been really the stronghold of American power, together with military powers, that financial power. And it's American. It's Anglo-American, I must say, because New York isn't the center of international finance. London is and always has been. But they're hand in glove with the United States. And that system economically is being threatened with the effects of all this spending and the sanctions, the effect it's having on the dollar. So I think things are already in the works as emergency measures in the financial realm, which could very well serve as the basis or the core of a new international financial system when the dust settles after this crisis.
Okay, so Mr. August, we're running out of time, but this is also a very important question. China has pointed to, quote, factors of instability and insecurity, which are increasing, and has suggested that BRICS members should strengthen mutual political trust and security. cooperation. Does this mean that we should be looking at an alliance between countries involved in activities far beyond economic cooperation?
I think we have already been a witness to this tendency of increased cooperation of countries, especially in the global south, to oppose U.S. hegemony and oppose what I guess many people in the South see, unlike in Western Europe or in North America, as U.S. provocations, especially against the global South. We recall not too long ago when the United States was pressuring Pakistan to vote with the U.S. against Russia in the United Nations General Assembly, the then president of Pakistan saying, no way, we are not lackeys of the U.S. So this has, you know, very far repercussion. That was a setback, what happened in Pakistan, but I'm quite sure this could reverse itself, and Pakistan could go back to the type of government that they had before, which was really a coup against it. So there are a lot of features, countries, interests that do not want to succumb to all the U.S. provocations that they carry out throughout the world with their 800 military bases, opening up new military bases, doing combined military operations with between the United States and other countries of the West in the South China Sea. So the more countries rally around BRICS and support that overall position against U.S. hegemony, and as you say, very concerning destabilization measures. So this new BRICS alignment expansion led by China is playing and is going to play a very important role in the international landscape in the coming weeks and months.
Okay, Mr. Arnold August, author and journalist out of Montreal, and William Jones, a Washington bureau chief of the Executive Intelligence Review out of Leesburg. That's all the time that we have for this edition of The Spotlight.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, Allah, Allah.
Today's great tip: why is it that we have a lack of focus when it comes to our ubudiyya, our servitude to Allah?
Allah, 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 Allah.
Now, dear listeners, we are talking about an interesting subject, which a lot of times we end up being a part and parcel of, and that is having a lack of a focus or lack of attention in our ubudiyya. Now, of course, if our mind is wandering around in a million different things, when we come to our salah, our daily prayers, which, by the way, on a side note, these daily prayers are considered by the religious scholars and the spiritual masters to be one of the most important pillars when it comes to our ubudiyya, right? So in the salah, which, as we just said, is one of the pillars of our ubudiyya, our mind is just wandering in a million different places. We're thinking about every other thing that is on our mind except paying attention to the salah. So why do we have this lack of attention in our ubudiyya? Why do we have this lack of focus when it comes to our ubudiyya, our servitude, our worship, and our obedience to Allah? Well, of course, there are many, many things that we can talk about, but because we're limited on time, we're just going to talk about perhaps two different things which create this distraction and make us lose our attention and our focus in our ubudiyya. The first one, dear brothers and sisters, dear friends, is that outside of our ubudiyya, meaning, for example, when we're not doing our salah, our daily prayers, when we're not doing the du'as, when we are not reciting the Qur'an, even though it should be known that when we are not doing this kind of formal ubudiyya, we are still in an informal ubudiyya. So, for example, the esteemed religious scholars and the esteemed religious spiritual masters of the current day and age and of the past, they have taught us that you can be in ubudiyya, in the servitude of Allah, at all times. So, in order to be able to categorize this formal ubudiyya, which is the salah and the daily prayers and etc., and an informal ubudiyya, which is occurring outside of these, sometimes when we are in this informal ubudiyya, we are totally engrossed, absorbed, and in love with the material aspect of the world. Now, because we are so engrossed in the material aspect of the world, and we are so focused on, and all of our attention and our efforts and our struggle is for the material aspect of the world, then all of a sudden when we come to the formal aspects of ubudiyya, you know, then we can't cut ourselves off from this materialistic world, and thus we have a lack of attention when it comes to our ubudiyya.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com. Dear listeners of the program Foresight, my name is Muhammad. Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from Munajatul Khaifin, The Whispered Prayer of the Fearful. Please stay with me.
نهاري دونكم ليل وليلي كله أنا العبد الفقير أنا.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. My God, what thinkest you? Will you chastise me after my faith in you? Drive me far away after my love for you? Deprive me while I hope for your mercy and forgiveness? Forsake me while I seek sanctuary in your pardon? How could your generous face disappoint me? I wish that I know. Did my mother bear me for wretchedness? Did she nurture me for suffering? If such, then I wish that she had not borne me and had not nurtured me. I wish that I had knowledge. Have you appointed me one of the people of felicity? Have you singled me out for your nearness and neighborhood? Then would my eyes be gladdened, and in that my soul reach serenity.